everybody. How are you doing? Nice to talk to you again. My name is Henrik Palmgren, and this is Red Ice Radio. If you want to take a look at our websites, redicecreations.com and redicemembers.com, there's more for you there. Today we have two gentlemen with us who have been called apologists for the Illuminati. They are, however, among the few in the world who have actually translated the ritual and doctrines of the Bavarian Illuminati. Jiva Singh Anand, together with Joseph Weges, joins us to discuss the real secret society, their origins, history, and connection to Freemasonry. We'll also talk about the rituals, what happened to them, and their political legacy. Well, all right. Welcome, Jiva Singh Anand. Good to have you with us. Thank you for coming on, sir.
Thank you.
And to you, Joseph Weges, as well. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you.
Now, this is going to be a very interesting program. We have a lot of material to wade through. We have a lot of, issues to discuss. You guys have, of course, been collaborating on the English translation of the ritual work of the Bavarian Illuminati. And this is, of course, the real Illuminati, not the the fable fiction that most people talk about today. But we have a lot to discuss, hence, to kind of straighten out and to do the best that we can with the time that we have here today. But why don't we talk a little bit of how you got into this work first, guys? It's always interesting to kind of hear how people get onto the track that they're on. How about you, Jiva? How did you get into this work and translating the works of the Illuminati?
Well, I'm a professional translator. I've been translating technical and literary documents for about 3 years now. And one day I was contacted by a client who asked me if I was interested in translating some documents by the Bavarian Illuminati. And of course I'd heard about the Illuminati. The first time I heard about it was when I read Robert Anton Wilson's Illuminatus trilogy. So of course it was something that I was interested in, especially since Dan Brown was publishing his wonderful novels, mostly fiction, but definitely interesting stuff. So I kind of jumped at the opportunity, and I translated Weishaupt's brief justification of my intentions. And then later I ended up translating Baron Knigge's, the original title in German is about a half page long, but I shortened it down to Philo's reply to questions concerning his association with the Illuminati. And at that time, those two documents were the only thing I pretty much knew about the Illuminati, and so I kept researching on the internet, and there is a lot of stuff on the internet that isn't history based. It's a story that everybody knows about the sinister cabal that's trying to take over the world and turn everyone into puppets and all these things. And then I ran across Terry Melanson's website.
Right, yeah.
And Terry and I don't see eye to eye on a couple of things, but his work on the Illuminati is definitely research-based, and he and I, we have a very cordial relationship through the internet on his blog and on the Illuminati Info blog as well. And he's just been a fount of information on the historical Illuminati. And I believe it was Terry that got me in touch with Joe. And I was actually in the process of working on a different book. It was Leopold Engel's Geschichte des Illuminatenordens, or History of the Illuminati Order, in which he basically outlines the actual history of the Illuminati. And then Joe said, hey, Jiva, how about we work on the ritual book instead? And Joe also had contacts with Reinhard Markner, who is a well-known authority on the subject of the Illuminati in Germany. And so Joe and Reinhard had access to the original documents. So I just basically jumped at the opportunity to do this, and I think it's a pretty important project.
Well, indeed, there's a lot of components to it. How about you, Joseph? What sparked your interest in this topic?
So what sparked my interest initially in the Bavarian Illuminati was, you know, you'd heard all these different conspiracies and things like that, and it kind of always has intrigued me. But I'd also had a deep fascination with Continental Masonry, and so it kind of got me going on down the road. Well, when I started researching this group, about 2004, 2005, one thing I noticed really quick is that there are a lot of, like, secondary sources that reference documents that weren't available on the Internet, so I took it upon myself to try and make those documents accessible to the public at large. One of the first books I started with was a book called Some Original Writings, and it was basically these documents that were seized from a counselor, Zvok, who was a member of the Areopagite. And the Areopagite Council was the ruling council of the Illuminati. They basically were like the head group with Adam Weishaupt at its head. And so anyways, when his residence was searched, it yielded a bunch of documents and artifacts. And one of the things that was inside there was this text called Better Than Horus. Well, I got to reading around on it, and in John Robison's book, Proofs of a Conspiracy, they call it a treatise wherein atheism and materialism are defended, and that really got my interest going. So I took it upon myself, and lo and behold, I was able to find a copy of this text. And so, long story short, I got a hold of this text, and the text is written like you read it from left to right, but it's in German, and you read it from right to left. So to read the text at all, you have to transpose it by hand. Well, it makes sense why the text would be written in Spock's hand, is because he had to transpose it to be able to read it, and really what the text was a piece on deism. So using the discovery of this text, I was able to get in touch with Reinhard Marchner, and he kind of set me along on my path and helped me gain some access to some things that I couldn't normally get a hold of. And before long, I had nearly everything, all the primary sources published and put onto the web. And I had it on an old Scribe account, but they canceled my account some years later. Well, they were nice enough to keep all the documents up there, so that worked out pretty good.
Oh, interesting. There's a lot of material, of course. I saw some of the links from Terry Melanson's page as well to some of the material that you got across. But this was just kind of, how hard had you worked to get across these sources, Joseph? And why do you think that no one else had done that previously?
Well, the one thing I noticed really quickly is that the narrative for the Bavarian Illuminati, it all is like, it's rooted in some place. And so taking elements of this narrative, I was able to search and come to the source of like what we now consider like the modern conspiracy version of the Illuminati. And what it comes down to is there's a book written in 1955 by a gentleman by the name of Emanuel Josephson. And if you go and you read this guy's text, it's the not only the origin of that the Illuminati, why they came over here, and they set up their secret societies, and so they reference all this stuff. But in it, they talk about this, and that Thomas Jefferson's a member of the Illuminati. But even crazier than that, the conspiracy theory that says the seal of the Illuminati is the obverse of the Great Seal, you know, the all-seeing eye and the things like that. Well, it turns out that it's also the origin for that conspiracy theory as well. So in this one text, you get two conspiracy theories, and I don't know, for whatever reason, people have just ran with that without checking all the facts. And then by checking into all the different facts and also having, you know, the ability to read and speak German, I was able to, you know, to comprehend a lot of this stuff, what was real, what wasn't, and it just kind of set me on my adventure.
Interesting. We'll get more into this here. But before we get into the details here, let's bring everyone up to speed here first. We shouldn't assume that everyone, of course, know the stuff that you guys know regarding, you know, the real Bavarian Illuminati, who they really were, why they were formed, and what ideology they actually held. And we want to do this, of course, to try to, you know, as you've kind of really detailed already, to try to counter the misconception that the Illuminati is somehow, you know, well, these days it's more like, you know, Jay-Z and his posse or something like that, you know, holding a triangle above their heads or something like that. But what can you guys say about the Illuminati, the origins, and just as much as possible of what we know historically? I know that there's a lot to it, but whoever want to pick up that, please go ahead.
Shiva, would you like to?
Sure. They started out as a student organization in 1776, May 1st, 1776. And they didn't really last. They lasted for about maybe 11 years tops. Definitely 1785 is when the last Illuminati Lodge was closed. And then after that, they just kind of lingered for a little bit. Originally, they were a they were basically a group of free thinkers who were thrown into kind of a very oppressive educational system. During that time, there was a reform movement going on by the deceased Bavarian elector, the Prince Regent of Bavaria, Maximilian the Second, I believe. And after his death, Charles Theodore of Bavaria became the Elector of Bavaria. And the other factor that needs to be taken into consideration is that at that time, the Jesuits, who had been disbanded, were struggling to maintain whatever positions they held throughout Europe, and they were trying to hold on to those. The educational reforms that Maximilian was trying to institute basically aimed at bringing the educational standards more in line with the rest of Europe, and they felt that the positions held by the Jesuits were just not doing that. They were just too focused on, well, does this textbook is this textbook in line with the doctrines of the Catholic Church and so forth? Charles Theodore was a bright but also very easily influenced person, and of course his confessor was a very strong-willed Jesuit. So Weissel was kind of thrown as a very, very young professor into this bitterly conflicted academic situation. Later, their ambitions became more generalized, where they were trying to merge with Freemasonry, and they were trying to also promote the ideas of Enlightenment philosophy, not only in Bavaria, but then also throughout the rest of Europe. And they did have a global vision. Joe, what would you like to add to that?
Well, I think, it's more like the standard protocols of the Enlightenment, you know, reason, virtue, things like this, you know, philosophical type virtues like that was what they espoused. Now, as far as like the origin of the order like that, if people will consider that, you know, that people think that it was this, you know, grand master functioning conspiracy. In point of fact, the ritual throughout the entire life cycle of this group was constantly in flux. You know, in the beginning of the group, it was more akin to like a college fraternity, like a something like that, where it was like an initiatic type thing. They only had initially like one degree developed, and they kind of languished for a couple of years as far as getting content. But the actual bulk of the ritual that caused them to expand wasn't written by Adam Weishaupt at all. It was written by Baron Adolf von Knigge that Jeeva had mentioned. And he's the reason why it was able to spread into Freemasonry. And by, you know, fortuitous luck of circumstances, they were able to take the demise of a pre-existing order, the Strict Observance, and able to capitalize upon it and collect its members into them to swell their ranks.
Right. Well, this is what I've heard as well, that it's really when Knigge comes into the situation, if you will, that things take off. And he, of course, has a background in Freemasonry. And from what I've read about you guys' work as well so far, it seems to be that a lot of the tenets, specifically then from the Scottish, you know, right, and the other strict observance, has been kind of borrowed and brought into the rituals of the Illuminati. Would that be fair to say, call it that way?
Oh, I make one exemption there. You say the Scottish Rite. What was going on was there was kind of like two schools of masonry going on at that point. As far as like there was like the regular that we, you know, today we recognize is founded in 1717, the Grand, the York Rite. And then you also have more of the Jacobite type masonry like that. And that's what a lot of continental masonry was. And so by Scottish degrees, we really are saying that they originate in France, but it was kind of a restorationist type movement, at least ideologically and philosophically was the point of it, was that they eventually wanted to put the Tudors back on the throne, was kind of its whole purpose. And of course that was, you know, very briefly in the forming of the of that kind of Jacobite vein of masonry, and it morphed into something else entirely differently. And that's where a lot of, like, when we talk about, like, the Scottish Rite today versus they have, you know, the Scottish Novice and Scottish Knight degree in the Illuminati, they both come from the same source philosophically and even the content-wise. But what we're talking about as far as the strict observance, it's something a little bit different than that. As far as them, they were strictly observing a Templar origin of Freemasonry.
Right. Now, let's see here if we can detail the path a little bit. I mean, you guys said that it's been fairly short-lived so far, and it seems to be, there's of course a couple of people that attempt to take over the role after Weishaupt, he flees pretty much, but you have Johann Joachim Bode, I think his name is, he kind of takes over the reins a bit of the Illuminati. But maybe one of you could just kind of detail us a little bit what we know about the Illuminati of the path, as you know, Weishaupt formulates it, and when does Knigge come into the picture, and are we clear at this stage in terms of like why really Weishaupt wanted to form the Illuminati and what the true ideology at the time was when he did that?
Absolutely. So Adam Weishaupt, as early as 1774, had been kind of thinking of the concept of it, and in 1775 he wrote down or at least what we have today is a partial document. And what he was going to call it was the School of Humanity, was like the first kind of like concept of the order. Now, in this document, he basically just kind of sketches out like a generic type constitution forming this society. And, you know, the first concept of it never really took off. So even as early as like 1775, he starts putting the ideas to paper, so that by 1776, that when they form originally as the Order of the Perfectibalists, they're able to... They already have like one degree written. And so like I was saying before, like, you know, they go for a few years, you know, up to about 1779, where they only have three degrees that exist at this point. They have Novice, Minerval Illuminatus. And it kind of slowly morphs and develops over the time. So it starts out initially more like a college fraternity, but they're wanting to, you know, teach the ideals of the Enlightenment, because at this point, Bavaria was a totally oppressive state, like Jiva had mentioned. And they basically, you know, prior to Adam Weishaupt, the professor of canon law at Ingolstadt University, they had always had, was a Jesuit in that position. And then after the Jesuit order had been disbanded in 1775, they kind of opened the doors for him. And, you know, like Jiva said, he entered a very turbulent period of history as far as his professorship. And now he had also been influenced heavily by the works of Rousseau, you know, other different French-type philosophers like that, where... that he wanted to teach these same type of ideas and virtues, and it couldn't be done formally in a classroom setting. And so that's what kind of gave rise to the whole concept of the Illuminati, was to be able to teach, you know, not with any sinister intention, just like the actual popular philosophy of the day, in a place where it wasn't exactly possible.
What extent do you think his background as a, you know, as being Jesuit educated, what that had to do with the picture? A lot of people obviously claim that on one hand, then, you know, his allegiance, if you will, to the Jesuits held true, while other obviously claim that there was a rebellion against all this that formulated some of the ideas. What can be said about that?
I think it's definitely more accurate to say that that Weishaupt was rebelling against his Jesuit upbringings. Later in his supplement to his intentions, he describes the Jesuit education that he received as mind-numbing and dull. It was basically focused just on rote memorization and very, very dogmatic. Knigge observed, though, that his personality was definitely was definitely shaped to a considerable degree by his Jesuit upbringing, because even though his ideas and the whole idea of making the Illuminati ritual rather than a set rigid tradition, making it more a fluid process type, but his way of leading the organization ended up being pretty authoritarian, and originally he had intended to model the Perfectibilists and then later the Illuminati on the Jesuit on the Jesuit model. And while he was able to pretty much keep his Bavarian members in line with that, the members from the more northerly states, that did not sit well with them at all.
Hmm. And why was that, do you think?
Because of his authoritarian and dogmatic approach to running the organization. Some of the required reading that he had set up for all the beginners classes in the northern Protestant German states, they were fairly well known, although in Bavaria it was still pretty hard to get a hold of them. And he wasn't willing to make adjustments for provinces in the northern states, where books like that were actually pretty basic reading for an educated person.
I see. Now, we're going to get into some of the Illuminati rituals and everything else mm-hmm. here later, guys, that you have translated and stuff like that. But I wanted to ask you first, Joseph, how many publications and documents, you know, from the Illuminati, their own writings, if you will, exist that we know of? And is there any further out there that is yet to be either found or translated or something like that?
Well, as far as like complete ritual manuscripts, there's one that's in archive in the Secret State Archives in Berlin. There's one full set, but it doesn't include the top two higher mysteries degrees, Magus and Rex, for the reasons that I mentioned before, that they were incomplete and not very, you know, they were not complete, fully thought out degrees. They were only partial manuscripts, more like outlines. They're still beautiful texts, but they're just not mm-hmm. not fully developed. But as far as like all the, they're still finding correspondence to this. And in fact, Reinhard Martner, his project, it's the correspondence of the Illuminati order. And one of the things that he does is he visits, you know, different archives, family papers, and he kind of visits these people's collections of papers like that and goes through it. And through that, I mean, he's found so many different things that's given such a broad and a deeper knowledge and insight and understanding into the order, just through people's own correspondence that still exists, you know. And a lot of the papers for Continental Masonry were confiscated when the Nazis came to power, because they saw that Freemasonry was some kind of Jewish plot to take over the world, or at least that's what they believed it to have been. And so they basically would close a lodge, you know, arrest all the Masons and send all their papers back to the SS. There's like a division called the RSHA, and they would search through all their different papers, you know, to find evidence of this plot. Well, they had a couple different publications, and of course, none of them were able to find this plot that they were looking for. But all the same, they held these papers in storage. Well, at the close of World War II, near the end of the Nazi regime, they took the papers of the RSHA and put them in some cave in Silesia. And they were able, and then also some of the papers, if I remember correctly, it was either Munich or Hamburg, I can't remember which one, but some of those other papers too also existed there, and a lot of it was damaged and lost, and the Soviets recaptured a bulk of it. So as far as the history of Continental Masonry, it was totally incomplete and inaccessible from the early 40s all the way to 1991 or so, 92, when researchers started going there. And then by the early part of the 90s, a lot of these documents were repatriated to different cultural institutions and from the different countries that they belonged from.
Now, let's back up a little bit too there, because it was obviously a period before this where there was a lot of documents being brought out of the region. And I wanted to ask you guys specifically more about the Schwedenkiste, the coffin or box that was shipped up to Sweden. And what I've heard so far is that the under the supervision of the Swedish royal family and the Grand Lodge of Sweden, they brought up or protected, if you will, the legacy of the Illuminati for a long time. I don't know exactly all the dates here, and maybe you guys can clarify that a little bit more, but they were preserved, if you will, in a large wooden box and brought up to Sweden. What happened there? And obviously, we can talk a little bit more about why they were so suppressed. What was so dangerous with the writings, if there were, as you guys have clarified so far, pretty benign?
I guess looking backwards, we could say these writings are pretty benign now. Because a lot of the things that they advocated are freedoms and liberties that we take for granted today. Intellectual freedom, religious freedom. To a degree, I think we probably live in a more pluralistic society than what they envisioned. Some of the documents were personal documents that had personal correspondences. They had names and so forth. And of course, at that time, it wasn't a good idea to have those documents published. They would have embarrassed a lot of people, because especially around the 1790s, in the wake of the terrors of the French Revolution, a lot of people blamed the radical Masonic lodges and the Illuminati in specific for the excesses that Robespierre committed, of course. The Schwedenkiste is actually currently in Erfurt right now, and there is actually a research project, a state-funded research project, where all these documents are currently being transcribed and stored in digital format. So there's a lot of the Illuminati documents. The original documents were actually published in the 1780s, 1786 to 1788, primarily to expose and embarrass the Illuminati, because their strength, they insisted, lay in their secrecy. Well, if all the rituals and all these plans and all that stuff is published and out in the open, well, there goes a secrecy. And in fact, after 1785, Weishaupt made it a policy, anything pertaining to degrees and so forth, that he actually outright and published it.
Why do you think it is, Jiva, that that they were safe in Sweden as opposed to it wasn't Germany at that time, but in the different, kingdoms, if you will, of Bohemia?
So what do you think?
Because it's kind of interesting, isn't it? That it's it gets shipped out, and right. And it seems to be all right to be up in Sweden, and it doesn't seem to be a subversive nature, I guess, when it comes up there. Why is that?
Well, isn't it in your country that the Masonic system like that? It's also it's the Swedish rite, as I understand it. It's more like it has a tie into royalty at some level. Is that correct?
I've definitely heard this as well, and it's certainly true that I think the current king, who's French, of course, but he's a protector of many of the different orders, and as far as I understand it, there's been a long tradition of that. Yeah, that's right.
Okay, so as I understand it, like the Swedish rite, it has a common origin with the Illuminati, in the sense that from the strict observance right there, the first lodges and stuff were running that particular rite in Sweden. So from a historical perspective, one could argue that that whole system is connected in antiquity. Not that it was the Illuminati system, but it was just it was a slightly different rite from a common origin. And also Bode back then, he was friends with pretty much anybody that was a Freemason. And so my thinking is that maybe some of the correspondence he had with some of the people, that were the more like the Girondin of the French Revolution, he was more affiliated with those type of people. Maybe some of his correspondences wanted to suppress those type of things. But also, some of his deals where he's got the Rex degree and the Magus degree. If it wasn't for him preserving copies of those, we wouldn't have them at all today, so we wouldn't even know what the text was loosely about.
I see. Now, let's talk about the tie-in of with Masonry here there and what you guys have found when it comes to the people. There's many members, of course. There's over 1,000 members who were part of the Illuminati. But was there something to the fact that there was that the Illuminati were trying to infiltrate Freemasonry, or was it simply that a lot of them already were Freemasons and once they were approached, I guess, to join, or if they inquired by themselves, etc. Was it just that the tie-in, you know, fit fairly well at that stage? What can you say about the connection between the Illuminati at the time and Masonry?
Oh, okay. Definitely they were. Go ahead, Joe.
Oh, I just want to add one quick point, and I'll let you get to it. Kniga was a high-ranking member of the Strict Observance, but he had basically become dissatisfied with the order. Now, the Strict Observance was founded by a guy named Baron von Hund, and basically after the passing of his death, there were supposedly these hidden superiors that were directing this entire Masonic system, but nobody could ascend to this level or was in correspondence with them, because really the whole system was more of Hun's own invention. And so it led to a power struggle, and at the Congress of Wilhelmsbad in 1782, basically the right was disbanded, and so there was a gigantic power vacuum. So Kniga at this point, it was already becoming dissatisfied back in the 1780s, and then he becomes the correspondent of the Illuminati. He gets put into the Areopagite Council in 1782, and it's at the same point where he's trying to swell the ranks. And so what it is he's enacting, Kniga, when he's writing the Masonic rituals, he's enacting a reform of the Strict Observance system into the Illuminati's higher degrees, because Adam Weishaupt wasn't very advanced in Masonry, and so there's no way he could have ever composed these texts, and so that's why he was instrumental in taking the Illuminati from a college fraternity to more of a Masonic type organization.
Yes, they were definitely making a run for taking over Freemasonry. I want to say their success was mixed at best. At one point they were in control of a considerable number of Freemasonic lodges. They had kind of a hostile takeover policy, where either they would set up their own lodges, or they would slowly build up a majority of their own guys in a certain Masonic lodge. The Wilhelmsbad Congress, of course, they saw that as their great chance. And one of the things that Kniga wanted to do was he wanted to make and he openly admits that later, he wanted to make a big name for himself in Freemasonry. Weishaupt saw the Illuminati more as kind of he saw Freemasonry more as a recruiting pool for the Illuminati, whereas Kniga, on the other hand, saw the Illuminati as a chance to reform Freemasonry. And in Freemasonry, you have a lot of people that kind of come into the tradition and they feel that, well, here's what Freemasonry should really do instead of what they're doing right now. Seems like every couple of years or so, somebody comes out of the woodwork with a better plan for Freemasonry.
Mm. Now, right, before we move on here, mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you, Jiva, again here, if the accusation, I guess, of the connection to the French Revolution is more or less accurate. I mean, we have it starts to flare up around 1789. We have some, as it seems like, at least some connection to Jacobinism. We have some of the French lodges at the time, like the Nine Sisters Lodge and everything. And it seems to be a kind of a congregation, if you will, of certain ideologies and philosophies coming out at the same time. Certainly it can be a mistake to just bundle them all up together and say it's all the same kind of ideology and whatnot. But what would you say would be the connection to the French revolutions and Jacobinism specifically?
In fact, that right now that is a debate that's currently raging, and right now the way that it's turning out, it is in favor of the fact that the Illuminati were definitely not involved in the French Revolution. Abbé Barouel wrote his History of Jacobinism. As far as ideology is concerned, the idea of equality and social justice and so forth. Yes, we have some ideological common ground, and we can also look at, hey, look, revolutions, they're popular movements. So it's not surprising that we might find one or the other member that might be caught up in that revolution. The big difference is, though, that the Illuminati, and that's actually, and I forget which degree that's in right now, but they actually did not put a whole lot of credence in the efficacy of violent overthrow. Their method and their ideology was not violence, but it was educational. It was education, and they had intended that to be a process that could take centuries or even longer than just centuries.
So they're more
That
long-term kind of thing. They want to
exactly.
slowly change and transform society, correct?
Exactly, because they felt that a violent revolution only ends up replacing one tyrant with another, because human nature hasn't changed by the revolution itself.
And what can be said at the time then about it and why this was so subversive? I mean, there is a, if we try to look back at history, I think we do make a mistake by applying our own current lens, if you will, and moral judgment and everything else. And of course, we can't do anything else, right? But it might not seem that the ideologies today are that, you know, subversive, if we can use that word. But you know, because we have actually already been brought up too many of the tenets in that regard. Maybe the Illuminati actually were successful in terms of the education and everything else that, you know, that you've been talking about here so far. But why do you think at the time it was so subversive? Was it just because it was anti-religious and going against the monarchy and the established order of the day, or was there anything? I mean, not that that's, you know, enough right there, but was there something else to it?
I might jump in on this one. So when we take a look at what the Illuminati's influences were, a lot of people don't realize this, but the Illuminati were influenced by our own revolution, and they saw more of like a fulfillment of like the natural order and progression of things. So when we look at as far as like the French Revolution, right, there's two main schools of thought, the Girondin and the Jacobin, or Jacobin, sorry. And they would be of the type that would advocate more for a limited monarchy as opposed to a people's republic. And the reason why they would advocate for such a thing is it when you look at all the different degrees and texts like that, one quickly arrives to the point that man's natural state at one point was the ability to govern himself, but he's incapable of doing this now, and only by, you know, taking small steps, incremental steps like that, will he be able to be capable of governing himself. But as far as their method of bringing about this change, it wasn't an issue of like, you know, let's get rid of the king, let's get rid of the duke. It had nothing to do with that. It was, let's surround these people with our people, and that way, even if he is a tyrant, you know, his advisors won't let him do that because they recognize that, you know, really the kings aren't the true powers of any state. You know, just as the president today is not the final arbiter of power like that, it's the influence and the people around him. So when they wanted to enact this reform, it was gradually through public education that people could be enlightened and brought to this point where they were capable of leading and governing themselves.
Jiva, anything to add to that?
Yes, there's also a historical dimension to that. Leopold Engel, in his History of the Illuminati Order, points out that the Bavarian elector at the time, Charles Theodore, didn't have very patriotic sentiments toward his own country. He was involved in a land swap deal with Austria, where he would cede portions of Austria to portions of Bavaria back to Austria. And the thing is, just 30 years prior to that, Bavaria and Austria were involved in a war, and the Bavarians had just managed to negotiate the Austrians back out back to their own country. Now, the Austrians were offering a Dutch province to Charles Theodore with the title king in exchange for some land in Austria, in exchange for Charles Theodore giving the Austrians some of the Bavarian lands. And that was something that was extremely unpopular with the Bavarian people. And so all of a sudden, here's the Illuminati. They've just been discovered. And Engel proposed that that Charles Theodore then decided to blow up this whole Illuminati story into this global conspiracy, if you will, in order to distract his own people from his own kind of shady political dealings that that he was trying to accomplish at the time.
What was the climate of rule like at the time? Was it a pretty much a feudal system, or how could we describe it, do you think?
Germany at this time was actually divided into many tiny little independent states. And at one point or another, they were pretty much all with war, all at war with one another. It wasn't until 1848 that Germany actually started to become a single nation.
We had the Weimar Republic eventually forming, and yeah, we had a couple of precursors to that. Now, if we could, this is very interesting just hearing about this, and again, I just having this idea of how we compare it to how it is today and what we compare it with today to get a context of this. But if we could put the Illuminati at the time in a political category, let's say, both of you could do that, you know, how you would see it. But I mean, we know that they wanted to influence, you know, science and education to a certain degree. Then we have a building of a kind of a political system, for the lack of a better term. But I've heard that they were, you know, utopian visionaries and things like this. But if we could put them in the political bracket today, were they a liberal, you know, Republicans that wanted to have self-rule, as you guys said, or where could you place them on the political bar, if you will?
Surprisingly, I would say libertarian.
Libertarian?
Yes, very much so. They believed in a government that was so far in the background that it was practically non-existent. Interestingly, too, they did not believe in the abolition of private property, but they were very much concerned about the concentration of wealth and military power in the hands of very few. There is a passage in one of the rituals where Weishaupt actually warns of, when we talk about it today, we would describe it the power of the military-industrial complex. So he was actually one of those people that actually warned of these. He warned of this becoming a major threat to civilization. He envisioned a society where of basically free people that lived in kind of like a patriarchic clan structure almost. And
interesting. Yeah, because I mean, one of the reasons too I'm asking is because some people have argued that the conception today, obviously, about the Illuminati is that they are they're among the richest in the world, they are behind all the power in the world, and that's it. While you have on the flip side kind of this is the root of socialism, really, and the tenets mm-hmm. really line up with Fabianism, etc. But Joseph, where would you put them on the political scale?
Well, I tend to agree with Jiva that by today's standards, now back then they would be like what we would call classically liberal, but then again, classically liberal met what we would call libertarian today as far as the American political structure. It was kind of like you were saying earlier that they were utopian visionaries. They definitely had some utopian concepts, but it was framed within the fact that you'll never be able to achieve any type of like meaningful utopia on this earth, and that's why it's a utopia. You can't obtain it, but it's something to strive towards. And that's kind of a lot of their guiding philosophy is that, like, though we may never be able to totally perfect anything like that, we're still striving for perfection as a goal to reach, even though we'll never get there.
Interesting. Let me run one thing by your hair, guys, and it's mm-hmm. a quote from George Washington, and I've always struggled with truly understanding it, because I think it might just be me and, you know, my Swedish background. I don't understand the language fully or something like that, but he said, allegedly, and I think it's in the Library of Congress or something like that as well, but he said, "It was not my intention to doubt that the doctrines of the Illuminati and the principles of Jacobinism had not spread in the United States. On the contrary, no one is more truly satisfied of this fact than I am. The idea that I meant to convey was that I did not believe that the free lodges of Freemasons in this country as societies endeavor to propagate the diabolical tenets of the first or pernicious principles of the latter if they are susceptible of separation." He goes on a little bit after that, but have you guys looked at this line, and what does he actually say here? Is he happy that the doctrines of the Illuminati has come to the United States, or does he say that he's happy that they managed to hold them out?
I can take that one. Okay. But basically, there's two letters that you're talking about. It's a guy named George Washington Schneider and George Washington. And George Washington Schneider sends George Washington a copy of Proofs of a Conspiracy. Now, this book's published in 1798, which is the same time that this letter is also published. And so what Robeson's arguing for in this book, based on the Abbey Barrel that Jiva had mentioned, but also doing his own concurrent investigation into it, into some of the books that were available. He writes this book, Proofs of a Conspiracy, and like it tended towards that, you know, well, the French Revolution, why, that's the product of the Illuminati, and it's all these atheist French philosophies that have led to this, and, you know, look at what they've created here on Earth. And so what George Washington Schneider had done, he'd read this book, and, you know, he was totally inspired by it, so he sent it to George Washington. So Washington's first reply is, like, you know, thank you for the book that you sent to me. I really appreciate it, you know, and he kind of blows the whole thing off. Well, George Washington Schneider writes him back, like, hey, no, look, you know, would you please look into this? And so I guess Washington had read the book, and then so what he was trying to argue for was that he goes, I'm truly satisfied that, you know, that maybe they've tried to bring something like this over here like that, but I can assure you that none of the lodges here are like that or of that nature or character. And that's what he was trying to do, is he was basically saying that, yes, I've got your book, yes, I've looked at it, yes, it seems plausible enough to me, whereas Jefferson said that, you know, that he basically thought that the whole thing was the ravings of a bedlamite or a crazy person. Mm. Not that he was a member of it, but that he basically, because, you know, he basically saw it as like, look, the guy's like a naturalist philosopher, and if they had written their stuff here, why, you know, he wouldn't have had to have invented a secret society. He could just preach it right out in the open, because we don't, you know, we're not prejudiced towards people like that. And that was kind of the nature of that letter.
Interesting. Okay, well, thank you for clarifying that. It's just that line that the language is obviously much, much different there a couple of hundred years ago, and it was not my intention to doubt that the doctrines of the Illuminati and principles of Jacobinism had not spread to the United States. On the contrary, no one is more truly satisfied of this fact than I am. And it goes back to what you said, Jeeva, as well, because it gets confusing in this regard then, because if there is a if we would align it to a libertarian ideology, as you said, mm-hmm. you'd think that something like the Illuminati mm-hmm. then would be welcomed under the banner of the founding fathers of the United States, and they would kind of fit very well in there, correct?
Yes, I've actually got that whole exchange somewhere on the blog, and I've been trying to find it while you guys were talking about it. I'll find it eventually. The idea was that I think the first letter ends somewhere with along the lines, well, I'm too busy responding to letters from strangers and therefore I don't have any time to read books. One of the things that we got to keep in consideration here that this is also a part of election campaign, presidential campaign politics, because we're looking at the presidential runoff between Jefferson and Madison, 1800, and it was also Washington pretty much suspected that this was just an anti-Masonic agitator. He actually addresses George Washington as the Grand Master of all American lodges, or something to that effect. And Freemasonry in the States is actually, we don't have a national Grand Lodge. Freemasonry is divided into jurisdictions that where each state has their own jurisdiction. So what was your question again, please?
Well, it was a little bit just about, you would think that the libertarian ideology that you described as being the tenets of the Illuminati would kind of fit into the what was happening in the United States at the time with the founding fathers and everything.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And Jefferson actually described Weishaupt as an enthusiastic philanthropist. So someone like Jefferson definitely would be in line of, would definitely be someone that would have a lot of common ground with Weishaupt and the ideas of the Illuminati.
Interesting. Now, we're going to take a break here in a little bit. We were kind of running a little bit behind because we had some technical difficulties here in the beginning, but let's give out some websites and stuff here before we take a short break. And of course, in the second, we're going to talk much more about the actual rituals and some of the writings that actually is contained within some of the documents. There's just so much more to discuss and talk about here. But you guys are currently translating a lot of material. You have going to put out, you know, books here later on. You're also looking for actually a publisher at this stage. Please describe to us what you guys are looking for right now, and if there's anyone, because we do have some publishers actually listening now and then to the program, and if you're interested in that, I don't know. But what's your plan, guys? What do you want to do book-wise here?
Basically, one of the things that we want to do is we definitely want to get the we definitely want to provide some educational materials on this this field of study, which is still emerging, and hopefully establish a hopefully kind of open up a subject that in the past has been kind of been shunned by the academic community, at least here in the English-speaking world, and basically open up that field of study. That's one of the things. The other thing is that I think it's dangerous to base I think that fear-based beliefs without having the actual factual background, I think that that leads to a very dangerous social dynamic. So one of the things that was our motivation, our intention, is to get the actual facts-based truth out there based on the original documents.
Yes, exactly. Now, you guys have a website where you publish some of this stuff, BavarianIlluminati.wordpress.com. That's one of the main websites. Are there any other, you know, kind of personal sites that you guys like to give out? How about you, Jiva?
Well, of course, I've got my translator's website where people, if they want to hire me to do some translating, it is firstchoicewriting.com. It's one word. As far as Illuminati-related websites, I've got a couple. I have, of course, conspiracyarchive.com. That's Terry Melanson's website. Marco DiLucetti's website, which is illuminatiofbavaria.wordpress.com. And then there is Bavarian-Illuminati.info, that is Terry Melanson's website that deals with just the Illuminati.
Indeed, a couple of good sites there. And we've had Terry Melanson with us before, and well, hopefully he might want to come back at this point and we can talk more with him, because his book is really excellent, and I've gone through it, and there's a lot of, he of course has detailed the majority of the members of the Illuminati as well, who, you know, kind of short bios on them all and stuff like that. And we might talk more about that in the second, guys. But how about you, Joseph? Do you have any personal websites or related websites that you like to give out here before we take a short break?
Yes, I've got two for you. Not my own personal sites, but sites I find interesting. So if anyone would like to have a duplicate replica of what the Illuminati jewel looked like for the Minerva degree, you can go to IlluminatiJewel.com. and get your own very own personal copy. Now, there's three of these things in the world, and this one is a full reproduction of the one version that's here in America. Now, the other two are in a museum in Germany. That's IlluminatiJewel.com. And if you want to kind of have a look-see at what the ritual may or may not have looked like, there's a gentleman who's got a really interesting set of cartoons, like a cartoon strip where he kind of animates what some of these different degrees were like. Now, his top degrees aren't exactly accurate, but we're working with him to get those kind of changed up a little bit. And his website is www.IlluminatiRex.com.
All right. Plenty of sites there. We're going to have these linked up as well. Before we end here, though, let's just clarify this first, because I was in on Illuminati Jewel and checked that the website out a little bit. That's obviously the... the Owl of Minerva there, because that's, I mean, you can just clarify that for us, Joseph, quickly, because many people still believe that the eye, you know, in the pyramid is their symbol, if you will, of choice, but it's actually the book open with the owl sitting on top, and is that the approved, if you will, Illuminati symbol, Joseph?
For the Minerva degree, yes. Now, the Illuminatus minor degree had a different jewel. The Scottish knight had a different jewel. And so forth. Like, then different degrees had different regalia, but as far as like the iconoclastic image of what the Illuminati was, if you're going to say it as anything, the owl on an open book with the initials PMCV, per me cache vident, through me the blind become sighted, or through me the blind see, if you wanted to put like an image out there, that would be it, but it's actually just a thing from a jewel necklace that you wear in the Minerva degree.
All right, very good. Thank you for that. We'll take a short break here. We'll be right back with more after this, so stay with us, everybody. In the second hour, as we'll proceed, we'll go deeper into the rituals, the order's hierarchy, and the structure of the Illuminati degrees. We'll talk about Johann Jakob Lantz, the one who actually died by lightning on the way to Regensburg. He had the documents of the Illuminati on him, and when he and the documents were found, this is when the hunt was on for the secret society. We talk about the way they questioned people before admitting them into the order, and Knigge's methodology of asking all these questions. How successful was it in spreading to other countries? Were they really atheists? Were they into the occult? There's a number of questions that we'll get to. We'll also discuss some of the more notable members of the Bavarian Illuminati, who they were, and later we ask what happened to the Illuminati in America, and if any of the revival attempts of the order were successful. There are a couple, and we have one by Theodore Roos from the OTO, for example, so we'll get to that as well. All right, well, we'll proceed at redicemembers.com. Please join us there, sign up for membership if you haven't already, and enjoy our full archives. We do have a lot for you there, including an interview with Terry Melanson on his great book Perfect Abilists, the 18th Century Bavarian Order of the Illuminati. All right, well, thank you for listening. We'll talk to you on the other side.